AI agents are everywhere, automating tasks and making decisions at machine speed. But agents make mistakes. Just one rogue agent can do big damage before you even notice. Rubrik Agent Cloud is the only platform that helps you monitor agents, set guardrails, and rewind mistakes, so you can unleash agents, not risk. Accelerate your AI transformation at rubrik.com. That's rubrik.com.
With the state of today's economy, it is more important than ever to invest in products that last for years to come. As the seasons shift and get cooler, make sure your closet is stocked with durable layers that stand the test of time from American Giant. American Giant's clothes work harder and are wearable season after season. Their greatest hoodie ever made is made of the highest quality materials that are cut and sewn right here in the United States. So you're investing right back into your local community. Choosing American Giant means taking a stand for American manufacturing and hardworking Americans, something other mega corporations don't care about. From fleece to knit, all in a range of colors for versatile daily wear, American Giant delivers everyday pieces designed for everyday life. Feel the difference of quality made-to-last clothes from American Giant. Get 20% off your first order with code STAPLE20 at American-Giant.com. That's 20% off your first order at American-Giant.com with code STAPLE20.
This is continuing coverage.
The Black Swan murder trial of Ashley Benefield from the Hidden Killers podcast and True Crime Today.
Now back to the courtroom.
State, do you know when your information was filed, or the most recent one?
We're looking it up now.
I've got one from November 16th of 2020.
I believe that is the only one.
Do you know? Are you aware of any amended informations, Mr. Taylor?
I'm sorry, I didn't.
Are you aware of any amended informations after November 16th of 2020?
We're just double checking to make sure, because it's been a long time.
Yeah. Are you aware?
Is the operative pleading that began this case, was it filed November 16th, 2020 at 4:34 p.m.?
We're just double checking before we confirm.
I'm not, Your Honor.
Yes, and I believe that's the only one.
That... Okay. All right, Ms. Benefield, the information that we're going to be trying your case under was filed November 16th of 2020 at 4:34 p.m. It has your name and the case number. It has one count, murder in the second degree with a firearm in violation of Florida Statutes 782.04, subsection 2, and Florida Statute 775.087. We'll talk more about that in a moment, but that's what we sometimes refer to as the 1020 life law. That is a life felony, so if you are convicted, you do face up to life in prison. And that information alleges that on September 27th of 2020, in Manatee County, Florida, you did unlawfully, by an act imminently dangerous to another, and evincing a depraved mind regardless of human life, although without any premeditated design to affect the death of any particular individual, kill one Douglas Benefield, a human being, by shooting him with a firearm, and during the commission of said offense, the defendant did actually possess a firearm, did discharge the firearm, and as a result of the discharge, death was inflicted upon Douglas Benefield, contrary to, again, 782.04 subsection 2 and 775.087. So, ma'am, I'll have some questions for you. If you could raise your right hand, do you swear affirm to tell the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth?
Yes.
All right, and the microphone's kind of close to you. Just make sure you speak in a loud, clear voice so it picks everything up. Do you understand the charge against you, ma'am?
Yes.
Mr. Taylor, when the veneer panel is brought in and I have all 70 people near the beginning, I will read the charge to them. I typically just read the heading, so I would say the case you're here for, or the state has accused Ms. Benefield of murder in the second degree with a firearm. I don't read the body of the information. Do you want me to read the body of the information?
No.
All right. I don't read the enhancements. I don't read the statute numbers. I just tell them this is the charge. Okay? I will ask on the Monday when we get here, first thing, that each side has a list of witnesses that they intend to call and to provide that to the court. I'm the one who reads the names of the witnesses to the veneer panel. So if you type them out, that's fine. If you handwrite them, just make sure they're legible. If it's an unusual name or I might need phonetic spelling, please provide some phonetic spelling for me. I don't say these are state witnesses or defense witnesses. I just read them. Just one long list of potential witnesses. All right. Evidentiary issues beyond those we've already talked about. State, we are going to have, I assume you're going to use some of the crime scene photos and the autopsy photos?
Yes.
Are they the same ones that I've already seen?
I believe the autopsy.
You can remain, please, you all remain seated for this. It's just us talking.
It's habit. I believe the autopsy photos will probably be exactly the same. And the crime scene, it will be more crime scene photos. But if you're asking about ones of the body, then
yes,
I believe those will be the same.
Okay.
And we'll have those ready on Monday morning, Your Honor.
Right, and I want everybody to take a look at those. How about, is there any crime through scene walkthroughs that are videotaped?
No.
And no body cam.
Some body cam? All right. Any of that body cam that will be of
no
the...
body cam. Sorry.
Oh, no body cam. No, I apologize. I'm
free
sorry.
Body cam. Yeah.
I apologize. All right, so Mr. Taylor, certainly any objections you have to the photographs that the state's talking about? Because what happens is, whenever our... This is all about voir dire, right? That's what I'm talking about. Sometimes in cases, as you're well aware, the crime scene photos, the autopsy photos, the child pornography, the child's, whatever it may be, can be quite shocking to the average person, right? We've dealt with it for years. First responders have dealt with it for years, develop some tolerance to be able to see things and not be as shocked. But I like to hear and I like to know if there's anything that's going to shock the jury, an average person. I didn't find any of the crime scene photos or the autopsy photos to be particularly shocking, so I'm not going to go into a big deal about it, but there's a portion where I talk about with the jurors that sometimes there can be some evidence or testimony that can be shocking or unsettling. And I talk about setting aside those initial reactions and looking at the evidence and considering the evidence in light. It's kind of, you can imagine what the rest of the conversation goes like. But if there's anything in particular you want me to talk about with them regarding these photos, the state will have them. You're probably well aware of them. Certainly let me know and I can adjust. I have more or less what I say in that particular arena. We handled the redactions earlier for the 911 call. Are there any other redactions that I need to know about?
No.
So, so we can avoid duplication of effort. Is the state going to play the 911 tape, in which case I'll defer to them to provide me with their redacted version?
Yes and yes. So.
Oh, I'm sorry. I thought you weren't playing it.
No, well,
it's called stealing the thunder, Your Honor.
We weren't playing it until it came in. So we will do the redactions, and we will give you a copy and a copy of the final transcript to see if you agree that the redactions are done appropriately.
Right, because then, of course, the transcript is not admitted into evidence,
right,
as we all know, but I'm just putting this on the record. So if you guys agree on the transcript, you'll have to let me know ahead of time, make sure copies are ready, and remind me to read the limiting instruction.
Okay. And the
edited recording instruction.
Edited recording. Yeah.
I assume the copies are made so that the jurors can follow the audio as it's played.
Right.
And I have...
And it's taken back.
Yes. I give the instruction. I think I've modified the standard just slightly, where I tell them, I don't think the standard instruction said, it says, hey, we're giving you this, it's to assist you, however, the actual recording is the evidence. I added a little bit to it because I wanted them to know, when we're done, I'm taking those transcripts back. They will not go back with you. Sorry, it's an extra sentence. Mm-hmm. Okay.
And are we okay with the way the transcript is now? I mean, if we take out everything that the
with
court
the
has ruled...
With the changes that were ordered, yes.
Then we will agree on the transcript with the changes that are ordered.
Yeah.
Okay.
Right. Subject to objections that I'm sure you're both going to have, right, because on that transcript, I ruled for you and against both of you. So... subject to objections that you're both still going to have to the rulings I've made,
right?
We'll get a transcript done that matches that.
That I think we all agree on. Yeah. Subject to that.
Yeah. Okay. All right. Please make sure your exhibits are pre-marked. Any exhibits you intend to introduce, I am not one that cares about state your numbers and defense your letters. I don't care. As long as each exhibit that you introduce says plaintiff, state or defense exhibit, and is numbered or lettered so that each individual item of evidence is separately identified and clearly identifiable from every other piece of evidence. So if you're going to have 3A through F as a composite, it's not just 3. I want 3A, 3B, 3C. On every single one.
Does the court have a preference of where it wants the exhibit attached? That is to say, sometimes they're on the back, sometimes they're on the front.
I'll leave that to your discretion. Just make sure it doesn't obscure anything that might be important, not just to you, but to the other side. And I'm just going to use this as a... This is a crazy example. It's just the first one that comes to mind. It's one of the reasons I hate anecdotes, because sometimes the one that comes to mind isn't a good example. But let's say there's a document that was going to come in from CPT. It's a crazy example. Please just listen. And remember how earlier you were in your motion, you had that stamp, and they stamp each page saying that it's privileged pursuant to this statute. You know, don't put your sticker over that. But if it's something where, you know, the sticker might obscure part of a photograph you want to use, I'm fine if it's on the back. If it's on the front, it doesn't matter.
And for purposes of marking, a lot of times, as the court knows, the way things unfold are not necessarily the way they're planned.
Yep.
In addition, exhibits sometimes come in on cross-examination rather yep. than direct. So my practice is I'll have them stickered, but I will number it as it occurs rather than number it beforehand.
However you want to do it, it's just too many times people show up on Monday morning or Tuesday morning or Wednesday morning, and there's, you know how hectic things are, trying to get the jury, no matter what day it is, and there's 57 exhibits and none of them are marked, and the clerks, no, it needs to be done and ready before we get here. Okay, and of course, make sure that all of your exhibits are shared with the other side and provide any objections. I would hope that I've demonstrated I am familiar with the Florida Evidence Code and the Florida Rules of Criminal Procedure, particularly those regarding discovery. I'm familiar with the case law regarding discovery in the state of Florida. We are an open discovery state. Trial by ambush is frowned upon and will be dealt with very quickly if it is not pursuant to the rule or the law. That is, whether it's witnesses or evidence or exhibits, certainly testimony. We just had an example last week or the week before where some testimony came out in a trial that I don't think anybody was expecting, and that happens. But to the extent that they are, it's evidence, exhibits, whatever it may be, photographs, emails, reports, documents, If you intend to use it, it needs to be shared with the other side. Any stipulations?
Judge, we have a stipulation as to, and it will be in writing, to Dr. Vega. Well, we've already done that stipulation, right? Dr.
Yes.
Vegas, it's already signed. And yes, we are going to have one as to ID of the victim. And there potentially may be other stipulations, but we'll have those in writing.
Okay. All right. Yeah, just if you can have those done and ready. What's going to happen, Ms. Benefield, is your attorney and Mr. Taylor is going to get with the state. Stipulations are agreements. Sometimes they're verbal, right? An oral agreement, stipulation. But they're preferably at trial when people are going to admit to or agree on certain facts. That needs to be in writing. Your attorney will go over it with you. Then the state and Mr. Taylor will sign it, and then you'll sign it, just acknowledging you understand that this fact has been established via the stipulation. Do you understand that?
Yes.
Okay. Schedule for the trial is, and this is a little bit getting ahead, is I'm hoping to get the jury selected on Monday. I'll go over the details on that in just a minute. It's a little bit further down. And just work, try the case. The first week, just for your knowledge, the first week I will have Wednesday bond hearings at 8:30 a.m. And it all depends on how many I have. A lot of times I'm done by 9. The following week, the second week Wednesday, I have bond hearings at 8:30. And then right after that at 9, I've got case management conferences. And there's, last time I looked, there was about 40 cases on there, which can take an hour to an hour and a half. Now, that's with the proviso that obviously if we're going and there's other judges available to jump in and cover those things, they will. But I wanted to let you guys know that those are possibilities because they are on my schedule right now. Yes. Otherwise, I start at 8:30. I'll generally ask the jurors to be downstairs in the jury assembly room at 8:30 a.m. As long as we can get our stuff together and get moving, then get them up here by 8:45 and start with whatever we left off with. That's a good segue into witnesses need to be here and ready to go. I understand that that may mean witnesses are piled up outside just sitting and waiting, but that's the nature of the beast. So if I look at you and I say, all right, state, call your next witness, and the answer is, well, we didn't plan well, and they're going to be here in 30 minutes, you may have just rested your case. Witnesses need to be here and ready to go absent some sort of emergency.
So just to remind the court, I have earlier told the court that one of the witnesses has surgery scheduled on the 1st
Thursday.
Of August, and I have several Thursday. Out-of-state witnesses.
Yeah.
Another one has a bit of a conflict. We're doing our best to get everything worked out, but unlike having all the witnesses here locally, I may need the court's understanding. Believe me, I want things to proceed smoothly, and I will make every effort to do so.
My answer to that is we are going to ask a group of people to give up at least a week of their time and perhaps several days into a second week, if not the full second week. We'll just have to wait and see how it goes. I think it is a small measure to make sure that we are ready to go with witnesses so we don't have any unnecessary delays. So if people are coming in from out of state, bring them in. We're absent this case getting continued last minute for some unforeseeable reason, because it sounds like we're still on track. They need to be ready to go.
Not much I can do about surgery, Your Honor.
Understood. Now, with that, though, 90.612, I think it's 90.612, allows the court to control the manner, mean, mode of presentation of evidence. So, and I have always found, at least in this area, the attorneys to be flexible. If somebody needs to be called out of turn, I don't think there'd be any fussing by the state to do that, to accommodate a surgical schedule, of course. But remains to be seen. But no, everybody needs to be ready and get going. I tend to, when we start in the morning, 8:30, 8:45, depending on what we have to do, I will take a lunch break, of course. I try and do mid-morning or mid-afternoon breaks, really communicating with the jury about how they're doing. You'll also hear me at one point tell the jury that in between witnesses or during bench conferences, this is usually early on whenever we have our first somewhat of a delay, I'll tell the jury, feel free to put your notes on your chair if you need to stand up and stretch a little bit. I'll usually joke that obviously there's no room for yoga or calisthenics, but if they need to get up and stretch, and that takes care of a lot of that problem. But I tend to do mid-morning and mid-afternoon breaks, comfort breaks, and then I really try and finish around 5 or 5:30, and I'll explain all this to the jury. I'm just telling you, I'm going into more detail, Mr. Taylor, because you haven't tried a case in front of me yet, letting that jury know that I try to stop around 5 or 5:30. Of course, it depends on a witness. If we're in the middle of a witness, I'm not going to stop everything cold turkey and make everybody come back. We'll generally finish that witness and then come back the next day. I have a whole section on motions, what's been heard and what hasn't heard, but I think that we've covered that. All right, the veneer, as I've told you, is going to be 70. And the way it's lined up, what will happen, obviously, defense, you'll be over at this table, state will be over here, and you'll be on the opposite sides, on my side, facing out towards the panel. It starts right over here in this first row, right where my deputy is sitting, to the left, our left of the courtroom. That's seat number one, and it goes through approximately seven or eight on the first row. And then, you know, 8 through, I think, 13, and then 14. And it goes on back this way. I think we usually get to about the mid-30s with that last seat. Oh, we also sometimes will bring in chairs, like you guys are sitting in. If it gets a bit crowded for some reason, we'll bring in chairs and put them at the end of the row so some people get comfy chairs. And then we'll start over here. It's usually the mid to high 30s. Again, goes left to right.
First row.
Yes, sir. That starts usually the mid to high 30s right there to about 43 or 44 and just keeps going back. Usually 70 is about three quarters of the way down on that last row. Again, depending on spacing, you know, if everybody on the veneer panel is my size, we take a little bit more space. All right. The jury is obviously six. That'll be the panel. I am contemplating three alternates, but I'm open to discussion on that. If I was really confident we were just going to be done this the first week, I'd probably just take two. I'm thinking three alternates just to be safe. But, State?
I think that sounds reasonable through the length of the trial.
Mr. Taylor?
I think three should do it, Your
Honor. All right, so it'll be six plus three.
How does the court number in the box?
Numbering? Oh. I don't care. They can sit wherever they want to sit.
Do you require them to return to the seat that they pick each time they come back in?
No, but they do.
They always do.
Yeah, it's weird how that happens. I tell you what, you know the thing? Well, you've done this enough. It's interesting. It tends to then also separate, men and women. I don't know. They just kind of take their own rows. I don't know why. It doesn't make sense. But no, I don't require them to sit in a particular seat. And they can move around, but they don't.
So you have the alternates mixed in as well?
Yes, sir.
Okay.
It'll just be however they come out and sit down the first time. Usually that's how they end up. They will have notepads, and we have court-provided notepads and pens.
Do you add chairs for the three alternates?
No. We use both rows.
Oh, it's right. We're six.
Yes, yes. Yeah.
Never mind.
We're not going to have 15. We're going to have 9 people sitting. I think there's, 14 chairs? 2, 4, 6, 8, 10, 12, 13. There's another one we could put right there. So there's plenty of room for 9. The way I do alternates is once we all agree on the 6, then we'll start over with the alternates. Each side gets 1 peremptory per alternate. And I'll just, it goes the same way, state, defense, until we get our alternates. The peremptory strikes, I believe, are 10. Somebody want to be heard on that?
No. Court allows back striking?
I have to. It's required. Now, here's what's going to happen, though. After we go through this whole process, and you've got your 6, and you've got your 3. I don't just mean you. I mean the generic you. We've got that. I'm going to confirm multiple times with both sides that that is our group. And then the deputies are going to bring in that group. They're going to be put, well, with 9 of them, in this first row or in the second row, and they're going to be sworn in. And then I'll give them some preliminary instructions and send them away. So I am required by law to permit backstriking. But once we get towards the end, you better speak up, because when I bring them in, they're getting sworn in. I do allow note-taking by jurors, but I do not allow juror questions during the trial. Certainly after trial, they may ask them, and we'll see. All right, for the jury selection, state, how long are you asking for?
Can we put a pin in that one? Because Ms. O'Donnell will be picking the jury, and she just had to go to the restroom, so she should be back momentarily.
All right.
Sorry, I thought I could handle that. That's my question.
All right, we'll skip that one for right now. On the pretrial publicity, I have a, which is, of course, one of the first things we're going to deal with. We're going to deal with the first thing in the morning, hardships and publicity. My intention, in order to not cause any difficulties with the entire panel, is just ask who's heard of this case or has read anything about it or heard anything about it. Whether it's been online or in the news or wherever it might be, have them raise their I use paddles. I don't know if I said that. I have paddles with numbers and refer to the numbers during jury selection. It just makes it so much easier for everybody, as opposed to having, you know, on a panel this size, we'll have 2 Mrs. Smiths or 3 Mrs. Smiths refer to juror 46, 15, and it's clean. What I'm going to do is we'll have them raise their paddles, those of you who have heard or think they have, and will make those notes. I will have already handled, hopefully, the hardships, the ones that say, I've got surgery, I've got plane tickets, whatever it might be. At that point, my intention is to those that don't have hardships and don't have prior knowledge, excuse them until 1:30. Tell them to meet back downstairs at 1:15 of the jury assembly room at 1:15. Deputies will bring them up. The remaining group is then going to be taken to another courtroom where they'll be held here on the 6th floor, and then we'll call them in individually. I'm throwing all this out there. You all have done these big cases before. I contemplated bringing them in parties of 5. You know, let's say that 45 or 50 of them we keep back, right, to make it move faster. But I kind of settled on individual. However, I'm happy to hear from either side if you think we should do groups of 5 or 3 or 10. State.
I would say individual. The only caveat to that would be if you wanted to bring 5 in and then we bring one person up to the bench, but we'd be doing all the conversation at the bench.
Yeah, and I don't like that. When I bring in jurors in, I have them sit right here in the front row. You guys are right there. I'm right here. Everybody can hear. I turn the gallery mics on. And what I've found is it helps people speak more freely about what their issues may be.
And these are the hardships?
Both. These are the hardships and the knowledge.
Okay.
Now, maybe hardships we could do as a group.
Right. We could, and I apologize I missed that, but we could do the hardships as a group. I think the media and the knowledge would be the thing that needs to be individual.
With respect to hardships, Does the court excuse for financial hardship?
It all depends. I can't. I have in the past, and I've denied in the past.
Okay.
So it all depends on the particular circumstances. Okay, so good thought. We will, right now, we'll plan on hardships. We brought back as a group. The knowledge folks, we'll just call them, will remain in the other courtroom, sequestered, until we bring them back individually. What I started with was how much state do you want, how much time for jury selection?
I generally do not go over maybe an hour and a half.
All right, defense?
I would like to think that would be sufficient for us as well.
And I'm being clear, I'm not counting the initial stuff whenever we're doing the hardships and the people with knowledge. I'm talking about once we have, I don't know what we call it, the final veneer panel, the final group, and we come back at 1:30 to really get into the meat and the substance, 90 minutes each. I think based upon what I know about this case, that's a reasonable amount of time for each side. Okay, this is me talking. If you need a portion of the law or instructions read, please ask the court to do so. If you have it handy, that'll be great. It makes it easier for you to say, I want to talk about this now. Judge, would you please read this instruction? If it's a jury instruction, obviously, and it's going to be, I'll give you an example, because this is a self-defense case. That's the entire issue. If you want to start reading the self-defense instruction, you know, the current, for the most recent version that came out, I think it was in May. Was it January?
Recently.
Whatever it was. It's recently. There was a complete rewrite, and it's voluminous. We may have to have a discussion of, you know, is this what's, if you're just looking at the standard, is this what's going to come in? Because there may or may not be portions of the standard jury instruction that are given. No soliloquies. This is not opening and it is not closing. You should be asking questions and not going on and on and on as a question setup. Make sure you're asking questions. No golden rule violations, either explicitly or implicitly. Explicitly is asking the jury to put themselves in the shoes of another. Implicitly is using examples that make the jury or the jury member, the victim or the defendant in a scenario. I'm going to ask that you avoid hypotheticals. If you intend to use a hypothetical during your jury selection, let's bring it up now, or you need to bring it up Monday morning. I'd prefer to do it now, sometime before, so we can talk about it. If your question starts with, what would your verdict be if, let's say, or what if, it's probably a hypothetical. Do not ask if, given a set of facts, the jury would find somebody guilty or not guilty. Do not use criminal charges to illustrate a point. Obviously, you can use the law of this case to ask about the juror's ability to follow the law. Do not ask the panel to apply an affirmative defense to a set of facts. Yes, sir.
Can we go back to the court's statement about what would your verdict be if?
Yes.
Part of my voir dire revolves around the presumption of innocence and presenting to the jurors a scenario upon which to draw the application of the presumption of innocence. Understanding that, then, I will ask them, so if, for example, you were to be told, okay, you have to reach a verdict now, what would your verdict be? And surprisingly, way too often, they don't understand, and the response is, well, we haven't heard any testimony. Is the court saying that that's prohibited?
Do I have good news for you? As part, my voir dire portion takes about an hour and 15 minutes.
Okay.
You know, some judges do very little and some judges do quite a bit. I am fairly active. When we actually get to that point, I discuss three very important legal concepts with the jury. which they've probably heard, and I'm sort of paraphrasing from what I read, which they've probably heard many times before on television or in the movies or in the news. Those three concepts are the right to remain silent, the presumption of innocence, and the burden of proof. Under the presumption of innocence, I will say, oftentimes I hear panels such as yours ask during jury selection, if you were sent back to the jury room right now, before any evidence is presented, what would your verdict be? The answer is invariably, I couldn't find the defendant guilty or not guilty because I've not heard or seen any evidence. Judge, you just told me that. And I say, however, because our laws are clear on the presumption of innocence, the answer in that situation is that you would have to find the defendant not guilty because the state has not presented any evidence and the presumption of innocence compels a finding of not guilty. And I ask them, does everybody understand this presumption of innocence? Does everyone agree with this presumption of innocence applying to Ms. Benefield?
And what about, Your Honor, if they go back into the jury room for deliberations and they're not sure about what happened? That they have some questions indicative of the state not meeting its burden of proof beyond a reasonable doubt. Does the court... You know, one of the things that I have found, Judge, it's rare that the jurors are going to acknowledge anything other than a nod of their head in response to the court telling them, okay, this is the presumption of innocence. But it's quite another thing for the lawyer, when he's up there, to ask them, have they ever seen a police car by the side of the road with somebody in the back seat, what's the first thing you thought? And the hands will go up and they'll say, gee, I wonder what they did. And of course, that, in contrast to the presumption of innocence, is completely inconsistent.
I have allowed that one. When somebody has wanted to use that particular one, if it stops there and just talks about the presumption of innocence, is that
yes,
the person hasn't done anything until it's been proven beyond. Okay. If it's along those lines, I've allowed that one in the past.
So I will try not to repeat unless I think it's something significant and if it's inappropriate.
And what you're talking about when they can't reach a verdict, I think that one I've seen asked, and how you're probably intending to do it is, you know, if you're a lone holdout, are you going to give in? Or are you the kind of person that's, you know, going to advocate for your beliefs?
Well, I ask that also. That's just not being intimidated by the majority. But my concern in this case, Judge White, the presumption of innocence is basically a requirement that they say, I am prepared to start this trial believing that the shooting was justified. Now, state, prove to me beyond a reasonable doubt that it was not. Because that's what the trial is about. Ultimately, it's self-defense, and was the shooting justified? And that's the instruction the court's going to give. So I would like to be able, within reason, to explain that to them and to present that to them as part of the presumption of innocence and the burden being on the state.
All I can say is this. If you're going to use a hypothetical, I want to hear about it ahead of time. Now, you may have used hypotheticals perfectly, and it always goes off without a hitch. That is not my experience. My experience with hypotheticals is it misleads and confuses the jury, and that it is oftentimes not a good analogy to try and get a point across, versus just saying, this is the law, will you follow it? That is, just be direct.
All right, well, I will try to be as clear as I can. I generally don't give hypotheticals, but I would present the justification issue like I just suggested, so that they appreciate and understand. This isn't really a murder case. I mean, we're not going to dispute that he was shot and killed. The issue is, was the force used justifiable?
Correct.
All right.
All right, jury instructions. I'm thinking back. I know I looked through the jury instructions that the defense handed up. Was that just the self-defense, or was it the entire set? I think I just asked for the self-defense instruction.
You asked for self-defense, and we included in that self-defense all of the statutes we felt the court obligated to choose.
So state, usually how the state does it is they prepare the standard jury instructions. So, Ms. Benefield, what you need to make sure you speak with your attorneys about regarding jury instructions, and sometimes people think of jury instructions as an afterthought, okay? Well, and especially as lawyers, like, of course we know the law. We've dealt with this. You know, how many homicides have you defended or prosecuted over here? But the jury instructions are important because here's what the jury does. The jury is going to sit in the jury box and listen. They're going to listen to the testimony. They're going to see the exhibits. That's evidence, right? And then I'm going to instruct them on the law. That's the jury instructions, where the court says, this is the law in the state of Florida. They're going to hear the arguments of the attorneys, and they need to take all of that. They need to apply the law, the facts that they find have been proven beyond a reasonable doubt, and making determinations of credibility, and apply that to the law, and render a fair and impartial verdict. So jury instructions are incredibly important. Make sure you take time and speak with your attorney about that. I'm sure you have, but I'm saying it for the record as well, to make sure you spend time on that. What you're going to see is the murder in the second degree with a firearm has two different kinds of what we call lesser included offenses. And what I will instruct the jury is there's an instruction, you may have seen it already, and it essentially says, members of the jury, even if you think the state has not proven the main crime with which the defendant is charged has been proven beyond a reasonable doubt, there may be lesser included crimes that have been proven beyond a reasonable doubt. The lesser included crimes encompassed by the charge of murder in the second degree with a firearm, I'm pretty sure it's just manslaughter, isn't it?
Yes.
The manslaughter by act?
Yes.
So what you're going to see on that list is Category 1 and Category 2. Category 1 lesser included are what we call mandatory, and they are supposed to be given in every case in which that main charge is tried. There's times when it isn't, but it's fairly rare. So that'll be Category 1 will be manslaughter. However, if you look at the second column, it's Category 2, which we also call permissive lesser-included offenses. What that means is if in the charging document certain facts are alleged that would support the elements of one of those Category 2 lessers, and there's been sufficient evidence presented at trial to support that lesser included, then maybe you could ask for those. So talk with your attorney. There are pluses and minuses, benefits and drawbacks for asking for lesser included when they fit within the information and with the facts. Sometimes the strategy may be, hey, this is all or nothing. We only want the murder in the second degree and the mandatory manslaughter. We want no lesser included. It's all or nothing. And sometimes the decision may be, well, we want to give the jury some options. Maybe we'll argue that I'm not guilty of this and this, but maybe concede something lesser to give them something if they want to fall back on. That will be completely up to you and your attorneys whether you ask for those Category 2 lesser included or not. Does that all make sense?
I believe so.
Does Your Honor give any preliminary statement about lesser included to the jury before the trial commences? Because we would request that the court not do
that. No, I don't, unless I read 2.1, the standard preliminary, that with a few very minor edits. But no, I don't think anywhere in there does it talk about lesser includeds. No.
We have some case law that when the time comes to discuss the jury charge, that we feel it's an all or nothing, including the mandatories that they do not have to be given.
Sure. We won't get into that now, but make sure, and I'm sure Mr. Taylor is very thorough and he'll go over all that with you. What you're going to find is when we actually really start digging into these jury instructions, especially the self-defense, which always takes forever, ma'am, you're going to be sitting over there with your attorney, and you're going to have your own set, or you guys are going to be sharing a set, and I'm going to go through each one. And the reason I'm going to be asking you most of my questions, did you read this? Do you understand it? Do you have any questions about it? Is because Mr. Taylor, as you've just heard, has seen these jury instructions probably 400 times or more. I'm sure the state is at or near 100. I'm over 100 jury trials. So we're very familiar with these. I want to make sure that you have seen them and understand them, because they're so important to the case. All right? And then we'll, so make sure you discuss that, because if you decide that, hey, we want to make an argument not even to have the mandatory lesser included of manslaughter, that'll be a conversation we're going to have, and you're going to have to agree on the record that that's what you want. And of course, I'll hear from the state. You don't have to respond now. All right, under 2.1, the preliminary instruction, do you want me to read that bolded paragraph about right to remain silent?
Yes.
All right. Also, under 2.1, I have crafted, every area is different around the state. Some places defense always makes an opening, and some places they reserve a lot more. So I crafted an alternate ending to 2.1, that talks about if you're going to reserve on your opening, instead of the standard instruction, I end with, at this time, the state is going to give its opening statement. The defendant, as she is allowed to do, is going to reserve her opening statement for a later time. It just tells the jury, hey, this is not unusual, right? Because every movie, every TV show you see, it's state defense. And I just want to let them know. So do you know if you're going to give...
Yes.
All right.
I would never waive an opening.
All right. If you're not going to reserve on opening, then I'll just read the regular 2.1. Finally, this is for you, Mr. Taylor, on concessions of guilt. If you intend to concede all or part of any elements of the alleged offense or any lesser included offenses, please notify the court for further inquiry with your client regarding her understanding and consent to that concession of guilt. As we did this morning, if you prefer that inquiry with your client be done in camera to preserve trial strategy, that can certainly be done. All right, general rules I have, no crosstalk. Make sure you're speaking to the court at all times. No speaking objections. If you stand to object, I want to hear objection, and then a short and plain statement setting forth the bases of your objection, or ask to approach. If you are going to impeach, it is imperative that you impeach correctly. If you're going to impeach with a prior inconsistent statement, if you are going to rehabilitate with a prior consistent statement, if you are going to impeach with prior convictions, whatever it is, you must be familiar with the rules. You must be familiar with the case law. You have to know the difference between impeachment with a prior inconsistent statement and refreshing recollection. They are different predicates. They have different purposes. Know the difference. If you are introducing past recollection recorded, that is different than refreshing recollection. Lay the proper predicate for what you are trying to do. On the impeachment of the prior inconsistent statements, as you begin the setup for that predicate, if it's written somewhere, you need to just look over to opposing counsel and say, June 23rd, deposition, page 6, line 24. So they can start looking while you are laying your predicate, because they're going to have the, and I'm pointing at the state because it's typically, you know, how it works, because they have the right, as you're laying that predicate, to say, hey, this is not material. Hey, the answer that was given here, where they're going to try and impeach with a prior inconsistent statement, is not truly inconsistent. Hey, the witness said, I don't know, or I don't recall, which this is not a prior inconsistent statement under the law. So just give an indication of where the where you're going to be impeaching from. And then opening. How much time do you think you need for opening?
Usually about a half an hour at the most. But
Mr. Taylor?
That's fine, Your Honor.
All right. I don't think that that is unreasonable, given the facts of this case. All right, Ms. Benefield, as we know, I've placed you under oath. I do want to ask, and I'll have to ask some of these questions again Monday, just to make sure. But are you presently under the influence of any alcohol, drugs, or controlled substances?
No, Your Honor.
Are you taking any prescribed medications?
No, Your Honor.
Are there any prescription medications that you have that you are not taking?
No, Your Honor.
Are you presently suffering from any mental health issues?
No, Your Honor.
Have you been treated in the past for any mental health issues?
I think the facts of this case establish that pretty clearly.
These are competency questions. I'm not going to start going into detail. I just want to make sure that she's competent to make a...
I can assure the court Ms. Benefield is competent. I have no reason to question it.
All right, let me ask this next question. Do you feel that your mind is clear and you're able to understand why we're here today and what we're doing?
I believe so, Your Honor.
All right. Has anybody forced you, threatened you, or coerced you to take this case to trial?
No, Your Honor.
Has anybody made any promises or guarantees to you by anyone to get you to take this to trial? That is, has anybody promised you anything about the jury's verdict, the sentence that could be imposed, any benefits, any drawbacks? Has anybody made you any promises or guarantees in any way, shape, or form about this case or the outcome of this case to get you to take it to trial?
No, Your Honor.
I've gone over the charge that you're facing, murder in the second degree with a firearm. Now, the next series of questions, I am not in it. I don't want to know anything about the specifics about what you've talked about with Mr. Taylor or any other of the legal professionals you've been dealing with. These are just confirming you've had these opportunities. Have you had the chance to discuss your case and the charge with your attorney?
Yes, Your Honor.
And has he answered all of the questions you've asked about the charge you're facing and the case, the state's case against you?
I believe so, Your Honor.
And you wanted to take your case to trial?
I suppose so, Your Honor.
There's no severance or bifurcation. Have you reviewed your criminal punishment code score sheet? Have you seen that yet?
No, she has not. She has not.
Okay. Do you have a copy?
I do not, Judge. I don't think that I've done one, but it would be a bottom of the guidelines somewhere around 21 years.
And I might remind Your Honor that at a previous hearing, the court advised her as to the exposure that she has.
All right. And that's what this is to get to. Ultimately, if we get further down the road, there's any objections to the criminal punishment code score sheet, just let me know. All right, so I don't know the total sentence points, the bottom of the guidelines yet, but we have discussed, and Ms. Benefield, I'm sure you understand that if you are convicted of this offense as charged, the court would have no discretion but to sentence you to a minimum mandatory of 25 years, and it could be up to life.
I'm sorry, Your Honor. This was covered previously. And I think to go back over it again now is intimidating to my client.
Oh, I'm certainly not intending that at all. Ma'am, do you understand the maximum penalty you face? I'll just leave it at that.
Yes, Your Honor.
You understand minimum mandatories?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay. State, have you received any offers from the defense to resolve this matter?
No.
Have you made any plea offers?
No.
All right. Ms. Benefield, if there's any plea offers that you want your attorney to make to the state, please do that as soon as possible. You do have three options. Did I go over the three options? Trial, open plea, or I don't recall going over. So let me just mention, ma'am, you do have three main options whenever you're in a situation such as this. One is you can try and work out a plea agreement with the state. That would be where you and your attorney negotiate with the state to try and come up with an agreeable resolution. Your other option is to plead straight up or open to the court. Some people say throw yourself on the mercy of the court. And then, of course, a trial, and that could be a jury trial or a bench trial. And at this point, we are set to select a jury on Monday in this case. All right, ma'am, so you've had a chance to discuss the case with your attorney. Have you reviewed all the discovery that we talked about? Is there anything that's surprising that you haven't heard about? Have you reviewed everything that you have, Mr. Taylor, with her?
I can tell the court we have kept our client advised as to all of the evidence and discussed the case with her.
Perfect.
I'm a little concerned some of these questions are intruding on the attorney-client relationship.
If you object to them, that's just fine. My intent is to make sure that the defendant is freely, intelligently, voluntarily taking this case to trial. And they understand because, you know, in 3850s, they come back and they say, I didn't know I could get life in this case. Nobody ever told me I faced a minimum mandatory. Nobody ever told me that the state was scoring death points. Nobody ever, wait a minute, I told my attorney to communicate this plea offer. What do you mean, state, you never heard of it? And this obviates all of those concerns.
I understand, but like I said, Your Honor has already advised her as to the penalties.
All right. Is there any discovery outstanding, Mr. Taylor, that would require a motion to compel?
No, sir.
All right. I'm going to continue to ask these questions because they're designed to, as I said, obviate the issues that I have found over my career to be common 3850 issues. That is, my attorney never showed me the probable cause affidavit, never showed me the witness statements. I never reviewed any of the depositions, and my attorney never told me what the depositions said or what the witnesses had to say.
I don't have any problem with those questions being addressed to me, Your Honor.
Okay. And I just make a note, Ms. Benefield is here. I want to be very clear that I'm trying to avoid those issues in the future. So, Mr. Taylor, have you reviewed all the discovery with her? You've provided her copies of depositions. You've allowed her to listen to audio recordings. Anything that you've received, you've provided to your client or gone over it with her. Is that correct?
I have thoroughly prepared my client for trial in this matter. She has no outstanding objections to that preparation. She is well aware of her exposure, and she has confidence in who she has selected to represent her, and we're ready to go.
All right. Then this is a generic question. I don't want to know names or times or dates, but to the extent that your client has provided you with the any evidence, exhibits, or witnesses, you have fully investigated those, and you've either determined to use those at a trial, or you've eliminated them from consideration.
We are well aware of the consequences of this trial and have endeavored to put our case together as well as possible, which included ruling out anything unfavorable and pursuing everything favorable.
All right, ma'am, as I mentioned to your attorney before, as part of the trial strategy, you and your attorney may choose to concede all or part of one or more elements of the charge against you or the lesser included offenses. I just ask that if you discuss that, Mr. Taylor will certainly bring it to my attention, but you have every right to, and I want to make sure that you understand that those concessions are being made. Certainly stipulations of fact, you're going to sign those, so that won't be an issue. But if there's any concessions, let me know ahead of time. If it needs to be in camera, I'll be happy to do that.
Yes, sir.
All right, ma'am. So at this trial, we're going to have a jury, as you heard. It'll be the six jurors plus the three alternates. Each side will have 10 strikes, peremptory strikes. And I'm sure your attorney is going to talk about cause challenges and peremptory challenges. I do talk about that a little bit more during the actual, or right before the actual jury selection process. So I'll explain that then. State's going to be required to prove your guilt on this charge or any lesser included offenses beyond a reasonable doubt. Any affirmative defenses, such as self-defense, will be your obligation to present competent substantial evidence of those. Then the burden will shift back to the state to prove beyond a reasonable doubt that those affirmative defenses don't apply or shouldn't be applied. If there's any witnesses that you want to appear in court, you certainly have the right and the ability to compel their attendance through the power of a subpoena. Mr. Taylor, I'm sure you've issued subpoenas already. And if there's more or others, ma'am, please work with your attorney on that. He can issue subpoenas to them to call them to court. If they fail or refuse to appear, you'll have the power of the court to contempt proceedings or orders to show cause and contempt proceedings to compel them to appear. Through your attorney, you'll have every right to confront and cross-examine the witnesses against you. And ultimately, and we're going to talk much more about this later, I have an entire conversation we'll have about whether you want to testify or not testify. And that's one of the most fundamental and basic rights that you have under both the Florida and the federal Constitution is not to be a witness in this matter. As you'll see and hear me say later on, the state cannot call you as a witness, and you cannot be compelled to testify. And I will instruct the jury multiple times during jury selection, during the preliminary instructions, during the final and the closing instructions. They're going to be told multiple times that you do not have to testify, and they cannot hold that against you in any way, and it can't let it affect their verdict in any way. Ultimately, the decision whether to testify or not will be your decision and your decision alone after you speak with your attorneys, and we'll have that conversation once the state has rested its case, and as the defense is or isn't presenting its case, we'll have a longer conversation. All right, ma'am, did you understand all of that, everything we talked about?
I believe so, Your Honor.
Do you have any questions for me that I can answer before I finish up for today?
Not at the moment, Your Honor.
Okay. If you had questions, would you ask them? That's all I ask. Believe it or not, some people are nervous and they're scared to ask questions. And when I'm taking a plea, I'll say this. If you have any questions, that's what I'll say. If you have questions, would you ask them? Because I want to make sure that you feel comfortable that if you have them, you'll ask them.
Most likely, Your Honor, she would direct that to me and I would in turn ask the court.
Sure. Okay. Is there anything else? Now, I've got a check mark next to everything that I had on my list. Did we get it all?
I have just two very brief things for the court.
Of course.
Not to offend the court, but I am considering, and I will address it later this afternoon, a potential writ of cert based on the court's decision to not allow Mr. O'Keefe to assist me. And as a result, if the court would consider with some alacrity reducing that to a written order, one sentence is fine, I would appreciate it.
Sure.
The second question I have is a lot more mundane. When approximately does the court like to take its breaks in the morning and the afternoon? And how long does the court generally break for lunch?
Oh, okay. The mid-morning, mid-afternoon breaks, I call them the comfort breaks. usually happening around, you know, somewhere between 9:45 and 10:15 in their 15 minutes. The lunch break really depends on how things are going. It can be anywhere from one full hour to an hour and a half.
Very good. Thank you, Your Honor.
You know what I didn't rule on, though, on your request for Mr. O'Keefe to sit at council table? You had mentioned, and I completely forgot to address this, and I'm glad you said that, brought that back up. You had also argued paragraph 11 of your request was the only viable option. Otherwise, would be for Ms. Benefield to submit a declaration of indigency and have the court appoint co-counsel. There is no case law or basis for that in the request, and I didn't hear any argued today. I am without knowledge of, and I could have sworn the statute specifically says that the public defender shall not represent someone who is represented by privately retained counsel. I've got it in my head that that's somewhere in the statute. Maybe I read that in the JAC.
That's accurate.
Okay. So denied on that point as well. Sit there. Okay, does that take care of everything for today?
I'm done.
All right, so unless I hear from you differently, I will see you 8:30 right here Monday morning.
Yes, sir.
And do you anticipate we're going to be in this courtroom?
Yes.
Okay. I just didn't know what if we were going to move to four. Someone said because of the technology.
No.
I just don't know how to use courtroom four yet. So.
And I want this as part of the record. Madam Court Reporter, I offer my sincerest apologies. We didn't take a break, and you have been going for multiple hours. I sincerely apologize, and I thank you so much for everything you do. My bad. She's going to yell at me as soon as we get in the hall, which she should.
More continuing coverage is on the way.
The Black Swan murder trial of Ashley Benefield from the Hidden Killers podcast and True Crime Today.
Press subscribe now.